next case is 99765 State of Ohio versus Paul Sepulcro. Mr. Lane.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes to discuss the rebuttal. In 1982, Paul Sepulcro pled guilty to various serious offenses. He was in prison, and for 16 years he participated in several rehabilitative programs. He received counseling, he received treatment, so that when the day comes that he's released from prison, he won't commit another offense. But when he is released from prison, be that later this year in 2000, or late in 2007, he will suffer another indignity. He will wear the label of a sexual predator. A lifetime label, not predicated on who he is in 2000, but predicated on who he was in 1982. His name, address, and the owner's label of sexual predator will be added to the Stark County Sheriff's website for the entire world to see. That label is vacant on this subject until the day he dies.
Well, just to be fair, he can't ask for reconsideration of that, can he not? And perhaps be designated not to be a sexual predator until it's not later.
Your Honor, there is a provision in this code that really gives cold comfort to any people who relate. The problem is that reconsideration occurs while the inmate is still incarcerated. He has no right to counsel. He has no right to call witnesses. He essentially has no due process rights. So we're faced with situations where inmates, most of whom are indigent, virtually none of whom are trained in law, many are illiterate, is faced with going to a court by way of a paper document and asking for reconsideration of a decision that the court made sometimes earlier.
Counsel, let me just stop you a minute and go to the procedural thing for a moment. This case, it seems to me, presents us with the direct issue. This is a person who has been found to be a sexual predator. And the question, and you're still questioning the constitutionality of the law, the same as in the prior two cases. So, are you questioning this statute is unconstitutional as applied or across the board?
Okay. This statute, as the court in Wayne's found, is void in its entirety. This statute, without any consideration of Mr. Sepulcro's case, or Mr. Williams, or Mr. Worthy, who has this court notice of this amendment, they haven't had hearings. Mr. Williams, Mr. Sepulcro have had a hearing. But this statute is unconstitutional because of the way it's written. It's also unconstitutional as applied to Mr. Sepulcro.
Based on double jeopardy and insufficiency of evidence, due process, those two things?
And vagueness, Your Honor.
Okay.
Vagueness is essentially a
facial challenge.
That is correct. In Mr. Sepulcro's sexual predator hearing, the trial court made its finding based on three points of evidence. The sexual predator hearing was held in 1998, but all of the evidence that the court makes its decision on to find Mr. Sepulcro's sexual predator was created in 1982, a whole 16 years earlier. Those three pieces of evidence are essentially the facts of the rape case, Mr. Sepulcro's statement to the police, and Mr. Sepulcro's psychiatric report, a report again created in 1982 with no consideration of sexual predator information, but to decide whether he's competent to stand trial.
But isn't it? Didn't Mr. Sepulcro, I know he had a right to call witnesses and present evidence. So, I mean, in theory, one would expect Mr. Sepulcro to produce psychological evidence that he is, that he's had a lot of therapy and that he's no longer that sort of threat.
Yes, Your Honor. And he did produce a lot of evidence that he has gone through at least 10 programs while in prison, eight of which were designed specifically for sexual predators. Mm-hmm. All of the evidence that postdated 1982 was in his statement. All of the evidence that the court considered that came after this event, after the psych report, after the police statement, should have inured to his benefit. Regarding the psych examination, Mr. Sutton look indigent. He was represented by a public defender. And as I believe it was Chief Justice Moyer discussed in one of the earlier cases this morning, psych reports are with the employee, but the statute does not require them. And there are a significant number of Court of Appeals decisions coming out of the state which deny psychiatric expert testimony in independence. A lot of the Courts of Appeals around the state are looking at these cases and saying, this man has no right to psych. So the answer that's coming out of the courts in response to Chief Justice Moyer's concern is, not only is a psych report not required, we're not going to give you one when you ask for it. So it is true, at this hearing held in 1988, Mr. Supercool presented significant evidence that he has gone through treatment programs and that he has taken positive steps to make himself a better person, to make himself not a dangerous person when he's released in as late as 2007. The trial court entry finding Mr. Supercool to be a sexual offender tracked factors that legislature laid out in 2950.09b2.
In fact, the trial judge not only tracked them, laid them out in his entry, didn't he?
Certainly did, Your Honor.
About the clearest one I've seen.
He certainly did, Your Honor. But that doesn't diminish the fact that those factors are vague. The legislature gives the courts of the state no guidance as to how they are to weigh those factors. For example, the first factor on the list is the age of the offender. The court looked at Mr. Supercool's age at the time of the defense, 16 years prior to the hearing. At that time of the defense, Mr. Supercool was 41. At the time of the hearing, he would have been 57. If he gets out later this year, which is his first opportunity, parole force deems him worthy, he'll be 59. And if he waits till the maximum sentence is up, this gentleman will be 66 years old. But the court, in looking at these factors, said age of the defendant, that's 16 years ago when he committed the offense, not 9 years hence when he gets out. If this statute is truly forward, if this statute is truly concerned with protecting children and all of us in the future, why would the court look at his age at the time of the offense? Is a man who commits offense at 41 more dangerous than a man who commits offense at 21, 61, or 81? We don't know. And I was pleased to hear Prosecutor Olson's candor earlier this morning when he said he doesn't know what theory of testing evidence means here. He doesn't really understand what the factors mean. I don't either. And the problem is, I don't think the court is safe either. I'd like to point out a couple other problems here in the court's entry. In paragraph F, factors, talking about pattern of abuse, the legislature, when it wrote this statute, probably had in mind, of course we don't really know because they didn't give us any guidance, they probably had in mind the pattern of abuse being that classic and tragic situation where a person in a family over a course of years abuses children or stepchildren. Unfortunately, those cases come to us far too often. But I'm willing to stand here today and say the legislature might have meant that the pattern of abuse.
In the event that that is what that phrase refers to, and I think that's reasonable inference, none of the factors then speaks to recidivism, right? None of
right.
the factors in the statute.
Right. This recidivism is essentially, what are you going to do in the future?
Mm-hmm.
This law looks at what did you do in the past and try to speculate on what you might do in the future. And this case is extremely indicative of the speculative nature of this law. One of the other factors in paragraph I talks about cruelty. Well, you can make a case that every sexual offense involves some level of cruelty. So what does that mean, that cruelty is involved in a particular case at a particular time?
You cited other states, laws for the states, and indicated that their high law is broader than most of the states.
Aspect, yes,
right. With respect respect to the hearing in the other state, is there, have the legislatures been more specific or more definite in the kinds of evidence? It does seem to me that there should be some requirement here that, other than just the general requirement, that recidivism is an issue, but the trial court is not required to make that, finding. It's a specific, or a key consideration, I guess, in any of its specific matters it's supposed to review. What do other states do? Do you know that?
Yes, Your Honor. The best example I can give you comes to us from New Jersey, which, if there is such a thing as Megan's Law, New Jersey is probably the Megan's Law. Ohio is not. But if we look at the case of D.B. versus Verniera, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals case, at page 1083 of their opinion, the court lists the factors. Many of these factors are nowhere to be found in Ohio's factors. Again, Ohio's factors are 2950-09-B2. And I'm not going to go through the entire list here, because it looks like there's about 12 of them. But for example, one of the factors is that the conditions of release that minimize risk of the reoffense, including but not limited to whether the offender is under supervision. The physical conditions that minimize risk of reoffense, including but not limited to advanced age and debilitating illness. Then it goes into some criminal history factors similar to Ohio's. It also talks about whether psychological or psychiatric profiles indicate the risk of recidivism. Another factor which would have been very helpful to Mr. Sopakul is the offender's response to treatment. And another factor is recent behavior, including behavior while confined or while under supervision in the community. In the Saul Sopakul case, none of those factors were even considered by the court. Again, if you look at the court's decision,
that result seems to fall much more into the same content.
Again, Your Honor, I think I should see that. case, I have to look at the facts of this record, and I cannot tell you that this gentleman is a sexual predator. That is true, Your Honor. I was a victim in 1982. If I could draw your attention, for example, to the book decision, and where the factual basis of the finding, the offense itself, the sexual predator hearing, and Mr. Cook's release were tied up in a much more temporal nexus. In the Cook case, the offense and the prior offenses occurred in 1995. Sexual predator hearings held in early 1997, so it's like a 2-year sentence. So he was released from the prisoners in 1999. That's a 4-year space.
Your guy could have committed the
offense to the district. And we have a presumption of innocence, Your Honor. We have a presumption of innocence here. I think for a trial court to look at a person who's incarcerated for 16 years and say, well, you didn't commit an offense because you were locked up, invade that presumption. And
no,
it's essentially assuming you could commit a
crime. The system is that parole school, smart to make a kidnap, get out of jail school, another 12-year-old victim. That pattern, we can talk about the pattern that we serve, which is the best one.
Well, it is.
With all these, the only time out is the judge has to go.
Well, actually, the court is required to look at the time you filed in prison, and obviously, you're not going to access the young girl's rights in prison. But again, the court is required to look at this practice, and the only evidence before this court during those 16 years was positive. That this gentleman had pled guilty and spent 16 years going through extensive counseling, treatment, and programming, so he wouldn't commit this kind of offense. And I think it flies in the face of due process, it flies in the face of a presumption of innocence for a court to say, you were locked up for 16 years now, but I'm going to assume you would have been committing rape on small children had you had the offense, had you had the opportunity. I see my time is up.
Mr. Chief Justice, Fred Scott, on behalf of the Stark County Prosecutor's Office, I would like to split my time with Mr. Norman.
Mr. Scott, We've read the briefs, we've heard these arguments again and again, and I have two specific questions of you. The trial judge's entry from Stark County says, the offender was approximately 41 years at the time of the present offense. The statute says that the trial court is to consider the following in making the determination. A, the offender's age. It doesn't say the offender's age at the time of the commission of the crime or the offender's age at the time of the hearing. Which is it?
I believe it's the age at the time of the offense, but also the age at the time that the person is released. I think that they can consider any fact, basically, in this situation.
All right, well, let me ask you a more specific question then. Under F, and I haven't read it in this context till right now, one of the things the judge is supposed to consider, the offender previously been convicted or pleaded guilty of any criminal offense, where the offender completed any sentence imposed for the prior offense, and if the prior offense was a sex offense or a sexually oriented offense, whether the offender participated in available programs for sexual offenders. Does that sound like mitigation?
Yes, it does.
If it sounds like mitigation, does that ever, on our weighing scale, prevent if there's been those kinds of that kind of treatment and his participation in it without any psychological report to show whether it's been successful, does that defeat clear and convincing evidence?
It could.
How about it should?
Depending on the fact of the approach and what the offender is coming from.
Well, we have a record in this case, and we know that he was convicted and he was found to be a sexual predator. We have an allegation that an assertion that he was involved in all these programs. Is that in the record?
That's the record.
The trial judge doesn't say anything about that, does he?
Obviously, the trial judge's option and discretion to weigh the effect of this program and how they figure out.
Well, the judge said there was evidence the offender had participated in a number of different programs dealing with sexual offenders while in the institution. Obviously, because of his incarceration, the success or failure of these programs is yet to be determined. Well, then, you'd never apply the F factor, because you'd never know. As a sexual predator hearing.
Certainly, but given the facts of this particular case, and as Mrs. Stratton mentioned, the fact that he was out for a short time, again, we have
none. Yeah, I understand those facts. None of them are nice.
Okay.
But we're talking about statutory factors.
And again, in this case, I believe that it's sufficient and appropriate for the judge to say, let's see how you do when you go out in the real world now. And let's see. I'm going to discount, I weigh those factors.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to discount the fact that you completed those programs. And again, that brought up during the argument earlier. He does have the opportunity to reapply when he has been out and does complete a program. He can demonstrate that he's overcome these base urges that have plagued him through his life. It's so evident in the record. Turning to the constitutional issues in this case, the double jeopardy issue, particularly seeking separate punishment for the same offense. I think that the Cook case, as well as the cases cited in Kansas versus Henry, Bernie Arrow and Harway, demonstrate that the requisite implicating and triggering the double jeopardy scheme, this court would have to find that the statute, the Megan Law statute, constitutes punishment. And in that case, of course, this court clearly rejected that argument. So, in order to reverse the double jeopardy ground in this case, we have to demonstrate somehow punishment occurring in this case.
In that first proposition of law, it's your contention, as I understand, reading what you've written and what you're saying, is that Cook is already dispositive of that.
Cook is dispositive.
Of double jeopardy. Okay.
Again, moving to the void for vagueness argument. The question that came up in Appellant's argument, as the number of factors, and that maybe New Jersey's statute has more factors than Ohio's factors, which we normally will address later, that the number of states that adopted more factors, but on its face, simply because a defendant or a citizen is not happy with a particular detail of the factors that have been listed by our legislature, certainly doesn't necessarily always rise to the extraordinary step the entire statute of the Constitution.
Well, yes, I guess I agree with that, but the problem we're having, I think, is the result partly of the way the statute is written, that is, the factors that are to be considered by the trial judge. We have a number of these cases pending here, you know, and a brief review of them indicates that in many, the trial courts are not being very specific at all. It almost would draw one to the conclusion, cause one to conclude that the prison officials asked the prosecutor to file, as filed, as we heard before, you're a sexual predator, without the kind of precise findings that would require trial courts in other cases, other issues. And so I guess the question I have, again, is the question I asked first case is, do you think there's a need for it, and do you have thoughts about what kind of advice, direction we should give trial courts in applying the statute, assuming that, well, independently, but the second question, do you see it appropriate for us to save the constitutionality of the statute by building in some requirements that the courts can appropriately designate?
I would turn back to Mr. Gorman's answer. That is, that the statute does provide specifically 2950.09b non-exhaustive back, non-exclusive back, is where she went. And I can only comment on our experience in Stark County, in that we run these hearings quite a bit. There's an extreme amount of screening that goes on. And obviously, in these cases, we have a record before us, particularly in this case, to indicate already of the offenses, and that you're already classifying people out to begin with. So you're dealing again with a limited pool. I believe Mr. Barley has even worse statistics on the number of sexual predators versus sexually oriented offenders and those types of issues. But I believe 2950.09 is so provided on the list.
You're satisfied that every trial judge can determine, basically, if they just use the required stat, as you correctly said, this is not exclusive list. The trial court obviously can use other means, but this is what the trial courts are required to use. You're satisfied that a determination of that a trial court can clearly and convincingly determine that someone's conduct is going to be X in the future based upon the fact is that the trial court is required to consider.
I'm confident that the legislature has put a good deal of thought and effort to set forth these guidelines, and I'm confident in our trial judges and why we believe that our limited experience in our county.
Following up on what the Chief Justice said,
all set forth.
say that if someone exposed one of these hearings requests that he or she be permitted to have a psychological report that would be admitted at the hearing, that that trial judge, as the trial judge did it, or in some cases said no, the trial judge couldn't say no to that, but that's really a pretty important piece of evidence, could be a pretty important piece of evidence. Either way, the trial judge could not refuse to order or commit that evidence to be admitted. Would that be a good addition, do you think, or do you think?
It could be a good addition, I don't know, in the context of our particular case, procedural history of how it's here. I see that I'm running low on time and I want to get to the wrong time. So we can simply have the court confirm the finding for yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Scott. Mr. Gorman.
Thank you, Your Honor. According to the numbers I have from the time of the Gowdy argument, late November of 1997, sexual predators registered in Stark County. This is not something that's being applied willy-nilly to people left and right every week. It's a carefully considered judgment by the prosecutor as to which cases they bring in and by the trial judges. And the suggestion that Ohio judges are different from those in New Jersey and New York and the other states which apply the same factors, and I hope you all, as I did, pull out these statutes and look at them. They're the same factors, and they're able to do it. I find it ironic that the state public defender arguing here this list of factors is too vague, and yet in the second district court of appeals, they've argued successfully somehow they're too specific. Judges are able to make these decisions, and these factors are not exclusive. There's nothing barring defense attorneys from presenting psychological evidence or any other evidence that they think is relevant at these predator hearings now. And the list of factors is certainly not exclusive for either side. Why is recidivism not a factor? Because that's the ultimate question. Is the person likely to commit another sex offense? In reaching that question of is the person likely to, is he likely to recidivate, trial judges are urged to consider a list of factors, many of which will be relevant in any particular case.
Mr. Gorman, let me ask you, and this goes back to the statement made in the previous case by Mr. Partlow, are you aware of regulations that have been adopted by...
Yes, remember those were discussed extensively in the briefs in the Gowdy case. And I can give you the citation where they begin.
In that case, I'm sure I forgot.
They were promulgated by the Attorney General's office. But they don't relate to what happens at the predator hearing, though. They're only about the forms the sheriff's offices are supposed to use.
Oh, sure.
And it does define who is within the community for notification. So go look and see those, I'm sure. I want to emphasize again, as I know I did in Gowdy, I think it's important for us lawyers in appellate cases and especially for you as judges to remember what our roles are in analyzing these kinds of decisions. We may not have written this law just as our General Assembly did, and obviously other states have written small variations into their laws as well. It's true, some states for the least serious offenders notify people of an approximate address, and they define that. So not everyone does the same way, and I'm sure the seven justices and I and the other lawyers wouldn't write these laws the same way. But the question before us now in these briefs and in your decisions will be, does the Constitution bar the state of Ohio from doing it as they've done it here? And as I listen to the recitation of Mr. Suffolk's sexual history, it just boggles my mind to think that the public ought not to know, and we ought to lock away in the courthouse the information about how he committed a sex offense, and less than a year after he got out of prison, committed another one, the second time with a 12-year-old. We're not asking him to go off to prison for an additional period of time. We're not saying you can't work where you want, marry whom you want, live where you want, to travel where you want. All we're saying is we're going to tell people what you've done in the past. And what use they make of that information is up to them. They certainly aren't allowed, aren't encouraged to commit any property or personal offenses against that sex offender. But they ought to know, and the Constitution doesn't bar us from finding out that information.
Well, we're also, to be fair, we are involved in the state. It's also not saying what you've done in the past, but what you're likely to do in the future. And that's the reason for our concern about the kind of hearing
and
evidence that are presented to make that determination.
Absolutely. And if trial judges in this state or any other state are not adequately creating a record of what they consider so that you and other appellate courts can review what happened, then the case ought to be sent back. But that's not a problem in the statute, and it certainly isn't a constitutional problem. It's a problem of what is going on in trial courts, and that happens in a whole variety of cases.
You
can fail to sentencing to anything. And it's not a flaw in the statute. So if they haven't done their job, then the case ought to go back, and then they can do it again.
Thank you, Mr. Farmer.
Thank you.
Mr. Lane, you've used your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Your Honor, in response to Mr. Norman's comments, the judges in this state are no different than the judges in New Jersey. The law is just, the factors in New Jersey code are significantly different than the factors in 2950-09-2. And this court can interpret those factors, but this court cannot add them. This court cannot fit as a super legislature and add those factors that would attempt to make this a constitutional law. The fact of the matter is, this is an unconstitutional law. Now, while we might make it less bad, this court cannot make it constitutional. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinions.